Well, you know, it's been said that the bigger the company, the larger is the probability of it becoming dysfunctional. And maybe that sounds like a really negative way to look at things, but I think most of you out there listening will have your own story of experiencing just that. And in today's episode, we're going to dive into it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense with your host, Doug Thorpe. Here's Doug.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Leadership Powered by Common Sense. I am your host, Doug Thorpe. And today we are going to be talking a good bit about what a leader can do if they sense and feel some dysfunction in the organization around them or above them. And my guest is Mr. Gordon Graham. He comes largely from the technology world. And Gordon, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so give us the short story of your journey and how you got to where we are right now.
I was employed with or by a public hydroelectric utility in the state of Washington. My longest tenured employment stretch was with them, almost 24 years. And partway into that, a substantial way into that, an individual arrived at the organization who made it clear that he wanted to progress, to grow in the organization. And that's fine, as long as you earn that progression and gain the respect of those that that are serving you and that you should be serving as a leader. But in his case, it became pretty apparent as time went on that he was more interested in feathering his own nest and advancing his own agenda than he was in the welfare of his subordinates and the organization as a whole. He ascended all the way to the general manager or CEO position and started doing some things. Well, actually, he started well before he got into that position, but he started to identify those people who had some, span of control and different functions that he wanted to bring into his camp. And if he was unsuccessful in doing that, if he realized that there was some resistance in that individual, then they became a target. And so that's where the whole concept of the title of my book, The Brotherhood, comes from, is that there were a number of us in that organization who resisted that that dilemma, that dark side, I guess, and concentrated more on trying to right the ship and put the organization back on the right track. And so we reluctantly fell into this this group, this brotherhood. My particular situation, I put myself, in that role, I guess, or in that, that persecution situation, because I asked to meet with him after work, and that's a famous part of the story, to discuss what I perceived as a dysfunctional characteristic of our organization. I wanted him to hopefully recognize that we should integrate the information technology function with strategic planning across the entire organization so that it bubbled up to the level of a strategic resource that should be managed and divvied up according to the critical success factors and key mission of the organization. Well, I think all he heard when I said that was, you're not doing what you should be doing to manage this organization correctly. And he identified me with that statement. And rather than open up the dialogue and talk about what we could do to improve delivery of technology services and to respond quicker, to recognize resource needs and divvy them up appropriately, he just identified me with criticism of him. And so beyond that point, there was really nothing I could do as far as saving myself.
You were a dead man walking.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah. Even though I recognized that, my mantra to my group in the IT section was to succeed in the face of adversity. And so we disciplined ourselves to become a world-class IT organization, if you want to put it that way. We embraced IT service management. We implemented project management for most of our major endeavors. We used the company's work order system to identify, record, and manage most of our service delivery. We established continuous improvement initiatives and tracked our progress towards those. And so we did what was right. We kept trying to inject ourselves into the planning process without much help. We kind of did it as a back end or afterthought. We would take the results of the company's strategic planning exercise, and then we would look at what seemed to be most important to them and identify tactical initiatives that we could perform to improve things like customer service for the entire organization, economies of scale, better service delivery, those types of things. But we didn't get any recognition for it, and we were never included, I guess, as a strategic resource or recognized in that capacity. Anyway, I'm getting kind of long-winded, so interrupt me anytime you want to.
Well, what I was going to ask is, so the notion of a brotherhood, I take it there were some others in other parts of the company that had equal concern and sense of dysfunction, and were they going in their own way trying to also recommend some solutions?
Some yes, and some you know, I mentioned the dilemma before, which when you get in that situation where you have to choose if you want to succumb and embrace the manager's philosophy, or if you want to you know, stick to your guns and what you know is a better procedure. You can check out mentally to where you still come to work, put in your time, try to keep your head down and just be anonymous, so to speak, but try to get things done so you can preserve your capacity there. You can physically check out. You can leave, find another situation, hopefully that is more beneficial to you. And, but you know, it's going to be disruptive to you as an individual and your family and extended family.
So just curious, this particular individual that did ascend to that CEO level job, how long was his tenure with the organization?
So I think he was there a total of 13 or 14 years.
Wow.
Before he left.
And had he been brought in by a board action, or did he just conveniently land in the organization and work his way up?
I think more the latter. He applied for an open position, came directly from one of the big consulting firms, Deloitte and Touche. So that was his last employment capacity before he came to the utility where we worked. And I think he wasn't recruited, or I don't think he had any existing friends in the organization at that time. He just saw the opportunity and applied for an open position.
Okay. Now, kind of when you started to sense this dysfunction and made the effort to do your change to what I take it is no avail, how much longer did you stay with the organization?
I was probably there another 4 years, between 4 and 5 years. I think when I had my conversation with him, it was 2000, 2001. I was gone by July of 2004. So it didn't take him that long to spin me out. But during that period of time, I was trying to do everything I could to show everyone else in any kind of position of authority in the organization that I knew what I was doing, I knew what I was talking about, and that we should actually open the dialogue and look at some of the things that may not be in line with the strategy and mission of the company.
So in your mind, was there ever any notion of change on his part, or was his approach the same all the way?
The same all the way. There was never any inkling that he would or could give any credibility to any of us that brought these things to his attention. He dug his heels in and pushed harder. Unfortunately, I just don't think he had the leadership capacity to sit down and ask himself, am I culpable at all in this situation? What am I responsible for here? And do I really need to change anything?
And how was the overall performance of the company once he took that top seat? How did it do? Was the, you know, financial outcome equal, same, better? What was the trend line?
I think generally equal. There are a number of things, some of which I couldn't fit in the book, that he became publicly criticized for, some maneuvers that he made, but they were sometimes recommended by people that, you know, at the C-level executive suite that served him in different capacities. But there were a lot of things that were of his creation that raised the ire of those in the community to the degree that he became really disliked and criticized to the degree that our public relations department had to create kind of a marketing campaign to improve his image. And they had to have public meetings and forums in order to deal with the input, the feedback from the ratepayers.
Yeah. So, kind of back to your personal plight and the others in this band of brothers, or the brotherhood, as you call it. What were you guys trying to do individually just to survive and sustain and keep from getting totally discouraged and immediately turned off by everything?
Some of this stuff, well, speaking for my own department and myself, I recognize that this persecution would ripple down to, throughout our entire organization, and people were going to feel it. They were already talking to me at the water cooler, so to speak, about why I was being treated the way I was, and were we going to be able to proceed and grow and have satisfying careers if this continued or got worse. And so I said, you know, we need to come together as a team, figure out where we want to go, establish our vision, advertise ourselves as an organization that's trying to improve. We need to get feedback from our customers. We need to establish performance mechanisms based on that feedback. We need to mature our processes. We need to do everything that we should be doing in a positive environment, but we're doing it in spite of the situation that we're in and the persecution that we're getting. So that's what we did. Some of the other leaders who essentially are part of the brotherhood decided to leave through one circumstance or another, either voluntarily or, you know, was negotiated with management in the HR department. Some of them turned to the other side eventually, at least to some degree. But to the larger degree, I think those that I really feel are part of this brotherhood, and there were and are up to, I think, 10 or more of those people, which is not insignificant in an organization like that, to have that many people who recognize that level of dysfunction and actually try to do something about it one way or another.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's one of the probably many points that come out of this, that there can be an individual that sort of rises to power and then changes the whole complexion of the company. And we talk a lot about culture and strategy and all that. And I think, who was it? I'm drawing a blank now. Made the famous quote about culture and strategy that, you know, culture can eat strategy for breakfast. If the culture goes bad, there's no amount of planning and good discipline and project execution that can overcome that. And to the extent culture ultimately starts at the C-suite, what people are sensing and experiencing is a quick drive through the heart of whatever the culture was going to be. So before this, speaking of that, then before this guy rose to power, what was the culture of the organization?
For better or for worse, because I've heard a lot of criticism of this, this organizational culture, is it was essentially a family type of relationship or feeling. The history that we relate in the book shows how the utility evolved very, very locally, very, very local influence from people that were power brokers and movers and shakers. And then the staff was all local people for decades. The managers, the people who occupied the manager's office, were all homegrown. They knew everybody in the community. Everybody knew each other, had gone to school together, had worked other places together. Had, you know, they saw each other in church on Sunday, whatever. But it was a family type of culture. And yeah. And like I said, for better or for worse, there was... maybe there needed to be some transition, and this individual was under the impression that that culture needed to die or be substantially changed. And the mantra, and you've heard this a million times, is we need to operate more like a business, right? This was a public utility, state chartered public agency. It was a government institution, so to speak, although it was owned by the ratepayers of the service area. The mantra of we need to operate more like a business is the observation that as a public entity, things have been too soft. We haven't had the rigor and discipline that we should have employed. People aren't held accountable for things. And, you know, perhaps some of that is and was true. I don't know. It's just that change management is a very disciplined thing if you want it to be successful.
Yeah.
And there's certain things that you have to do in order to ensure that success. If you just come in and say, we're not going to do this anymore, it's going to be this way, you will have a lot of disruption without the communication respect that's necessary in the first place to establish the environment to start discussing change and to what degree things should change.
Yeah, most definitely. Well, Gordon, I'll tell you what, it's time for us to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to dive in a little more of this dynamic of a dysfunctional environment and what can a leader do who's downstream from that and needing to fight through it. So hang with us, everybody. We'll be right back.
Business is all about solving complex problems as fast as you can create them. Become the best problem solver by leading others to greatness too. And the first step is going to DougThorpe.com. Doug Thorpe is known globally for coaching entrepreneurs and business leaders, improving their performance and the work output of everyone surrounding them. You can find health, wealth, and happiness by learning to lead others to health, wealth, and happiness. Go to DougThorpe.com now and order Doug's books or hire him to coach your managers. That's Doug, T-H-O-R-P-E.com.
All right, everyone, we're back. You are listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, and I am talking today with Gordon Graham. We're talking about a story that is sadly more prevalent than a lot of us would like to believe. It's the story of a creation of a kind of a dysfunctional, maybe some would go as far as to call a toxic environment with a senior leader that comes in, takes over, changes the whole culture, and leaves those that are long-term legacy employees to kind of suffer under that. Gordon, I was going to ask you the question, as a leader in that organization, what did you decide to do for the people that reported to you, the people you had responsibility for while all this junk was going on above your head?
I'm sure you can imagine the difficulty of that situation, but my main objective was to keep their morale at a point where they just didn't mentally check out and quit performing. That would have been disastrous. So I wanted to give them something to hang on to. And that's what I was talking about a little bit about earlier, where If we established our own mission and vision as a department, then it would give them something to identify with. And so what we did, we had a facilitated session, actually more than one, where we focused on trying to adopt a slogan and a logo and marketing pieces, business cards, something we could leave on somebody's desk if a staff member was there to service their personal computer, for instance. We used it as a letterhead. And so everywhere that we presented ourselves or people encountered us within the organization, they would see this logo and our mission statement and our slogan. So everybody had that to cling to. And then I negotiated with the people who were put in charge of me, and the book does a pretty good job of talking about how they tried to diminish my capacity by putting someone in charge of me between me and other layers of management who had no information technology experience. And it's an age-old trick to try to make you feel like, well, maybe you're not so special and maybe you don't really have any skills that nobody else could do. And it's humbling. So it does cause you some introspection, but in this situation, it was totally to assassinate my character and make me look irrelevant within the organization. So I had to do, well, we, because I had to sell this idea to my staff. We had to try to create an environment where people could feel good about coming to work, still perform their duties, think that they had the opportunity to advance. And so my biggest responsibility was just communication and more communication. This is what we're faced with. This is how things are likely to go. This is what we can do in response to that. Keep your head up, and I'll try to do everything I can to keep things from, becoming something that we don't want to occur, and that you would not feel comfortable working in.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's people out there listening to this that have had that same kind of experience. They've rocked along, built a great reputation and a good solid career, only to have some senior manager move in from potentially outside the company and all of a sudden declare that you're not significant, you're not what they're looking for as a senior leader on their team, and therefore you get relegated to some other role and duty and responsibility. And probably the hope is that you would just pack it up and leave. But if you make the choice to embrace whatever the change was and move forward, making the best of it, you end up making them the fool for having done it the way they did it. I can certainly think of a chapter in my life when that happened and when that transition was set up and put in motion. I was taken out of a leadership role that I'd been in for 15 years and put into a sales role. And the rationale was, well, gee, Doug, you've been complaining for years about needing a sales guy in your line of business, so we're going to let you be that guy. And I said, yeah, but that's not what I was asking for. But I made a 48-hour transition. That was announced on a Friday, and I went home and thought about it all weekend and went in during part of the weekend and moved my office to the place that they were going to allow me to have, and was ready to go first thing Monday morning in the new role, and went in with guns blazing and stayed there three more years. And then finally there was a whole other shift of things, and I was offered an early retirement package, which I couldn't, which I was happy to take at the time. So, but that was another, like I said, 3 years after the other event. So, and you know, it, you make a choice of what you want to do, and you might say, well, I'm going to commit, and I'm, for the good of my own team and my sense of purpose in this line of business, I'm going to try to keep doing the work I think we can do and create the value that I think we can add.
Yeah, you really can't do anything else. Well, you can. And what we talked about before, you can mentally check out, you can physically check out, or you can steel yourself, so to speak, and dedicate yourself to succeeding in an adverse environment like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So beyond that, what would your advice be to somebody who might be facing that right now and that's listening in with us?
So I actually did a piece with my self-publishing company on organizational dysfunction. And admittedly, it's based on material from other organizations. And so we definitely gave credit to the people that deserve it, but it's very good as far as a kind of a guideline or a list to be able to recognize if your organization is suffering from dysfunction or beginning to stray from the mission and vision and strategy that is known to you as an employee. And there are certain things that you can recognize, compliance issues, like in our case, being a state chartered public agency, a lot of our administrative instructions, rules, guidelines, procedures, so forth, are all developed from state law, state administrative code. And they deal with things like how to procure resources, including contractors and that type of thing, how to hire somebody, the whole employment process. Well, our general manager, during his tenure there, as soon as he got enough power to be able to do it, began to circumvent all of our internal procedures and administrative instruction. And so we were in a situation where we were observing the ultimate leader in our organization actually flying in the face of the things that we were expected to follow, all the procedures that we were expected to execute down to the letter. And he was apparently not expected to do that. It's kind of the rules for thee, but not for me. So that was a big issue. And then other things, you would expect that somebody in that capacity would be interested in trying to develop team cohesion, departmental cohesion, everything that he could to help make the best use of resources and to increase communication. But he took the opposite approach and pitted people against each other. There were a number of circumstances or things that you could recognize, like unwarranted promotions, the champion mentality where he picked somebody who was a favorite of his to manage a project who didn't have any qualifications to do so. So it was a kind of a make or break situation for that person, but really a ill-advised move in the first place. Just the endless turmoil, and like you mentioned earlier, the toxic work environment, persecution, things like I mentioned in my book, trying to force people out through constructive discharge or constructive termination, making it impossible for them to stay, so they choose to leave. Those are all signs, very, very big signs of organizational dysfunction. And what we did, what I did, because I can really only speak for myself, but I think our department may be the best example of one during that period of time that tried to confront, there's really no other word for it. We did try to confront the agenda and try to get it diverted or modified, I guess, back to the original strategy of the organization. And initially, the first step that I took, and actually part of this piece that I developed to be distributed through my blog, what you would really hope is that you could sit down with that particular individual, the CEO, and impress upon them the need to really get introspective and think about whether or not they recognize the things that you're recognizing. And given that, if they do recognize those things, then is there something they feel like they can do to correct it, or should do to correct it, and try to get input from as many parts of the organization as you can to achieve that? So that's the first step. You would hope that that individual would have an awakening and realize, well, hey, we're going the wrong way. Well, that was obviously not an option in our situation, because I had that conversation with that individual and it didn't work out. So the next step, I guess, would be to try to build more support for what your observations are. So you look at your peers in the organization and try to create kind of an intervention situation where you've got more than just yourself spitting into the wind, so to speak. You've got a group of people who are saying the same thing, and it can't be ignored. It's going to make enough noise to where they got to pay attention. That's the idea anyway. Well, I tried that, and people were so scared that I couldn't really build any kind of, I guess, coalition or group to be able to move that forward. Yep.
Poor group.
So then the third choice, and this should be, I think, the ultimate last choice, is to approach elected board members, commissioners, whatever that organization is in your company that has oversight responsibility, because they, more than anybody, should be interested in things that you view as dysfunctional, and trying to figure out whether that or not they give any credibility to that. It should have been a pretty easy task to get somebody's attention there. And once you get one, that person starts talking to the rest of the board members. And then at some point there's enough of them to where they get the manager's attention, and he realizes that he's going to have to talk about it.
Yeah.
So I tried that, and my character had been assassinated. I had been pigeonholed to the point where nobody wanted to listen to me. And without the coalition, without the team to back me up for the intervention, it was just me trying to raise the awareness. And so I couldn't get the attention of any board members at all.
And the risk is, as the single voice trying to rise up and do that, you quickly get tagged as the, you know, the guy with sour grapes, and it's an easy excuse. And if any of the people around the boardroom are still aligned with the leader who's causing all this dysfunction, then, you know, it, you're really on the short end of that power struggle.
And that was the situation. He had at least three of the five board members in his pocket, so to speak. So I really wasn't going to, none of us were going to be able to accomplish much that way.
Yeah.
So the last resort, and the one that I ended up ultimately taking, was to go public, and to coincidentally file for protection through the whistleblower mechanism that we had in our organization. So then the public knows everything that you know, the newspaper knows it, the commissioners know everything. It's right there for everybody to see. So whether they give you any credibility or not is up to their conscience and how it's conveyed, I guess. So those are the steps, I guess, if you recognize the dysfunction, at least my experience and the things that I saw in other stories I pick up on LinkedIn, and then people who've read my book, they tell me, it's amazing how many people say, man, I really identified with this because I went through the same thing or something very similar.
Yeah. Well, it's really compelling. And I think, and like I said, at the top of the show, it's sad how many times these kinds of things happen. There's a very compelling documentary that's been created on the whole plight of Boeing and the aircraft tragedy, the two planes that crashed, and everything that was subsequently discovered on why that was allowed to happen. And, you know, that was with the 777 aircraft. But it ultimately came down to a shift in a what had been the legacy culture at the original Boeing. Their commitment to quality and execution and reliability all got eroded through a series of merger transactions with voices from outside the company coming in and taking over. And the culture that had formerly for 30 years secured high quality, high reliability just went out the window. Mm-hmm. And people that wanted to keep operating that way were shut down. I mean, they were ostracized and blackballed and threatened and, you know, a lot of those kinds of things. And so call that a kind of severe dysfunction for sure.
Absolutely.
But my point is, it does happen. And sadly, it happens at an alarming rate, really, when you think about it. And it's kind of, this is a grossly oversimplified, but it's a story that I use a lot in my coaching. It's kind of like the frog in the pot, you know, and the story says, if you boil a pot of water and drop a frog in it, he's immediately going to jump out because he wants to protect himself. But if you put him in cool water and slowly turn up the temperature, he'll boil to death.
Yep. That's a pretty famous parable.
And that is applicable to so many business situations.
Oh, it is.
Some sense of quality, commitment, and standard that is high slowly starts to erode. It's like the heat getting turned up on that pot of water. You're sitting there trying to do your job, do the best you know how, and all of a sudden one day you wake up and it's not the same company that you went to work for.
So, how true.
It's a horrible malady. Well, Gordon, if somebody wants to get a hold of the book or get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Well, it's available on most book outlets, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, of course, either in paperback or like Kindle form, electronic, Apple Books. If If you go to the website, intrepidbrotherhood.com, it has all of the book links there, places you can get it. Looks like this. Oh, it's on the plaque on the wall too. That's probably the Amazon's probably the easiest place to get it. And it's readily available out there. I've got a number of things going on the website. There's testimonials there from other Brotherhood members, from people in the community that knew what was going on at the time, from commissioners that prevailed in reform elections or reform candidates who prevailed, that I was in touch with just before I had to leave the area, leave the community, and supported their campaigns. There's at least one of them that provided me a testimonial. There's the opportunity to subscribe to my email list out there where you can pretty much ensure that you're going to be pestered by my blog posts. And what I do there is I try to share things that I've gleaned from other leadership resources, but maybe the most interesting things that people will find out there, I'm going to try to put stories, tales from my experiences at this company, and some of my direct reports, some of my colleagues who provided me some feedback, and then other Brotherhood members. I hope that I'm trying to engage them because they've got some great anecdotes and stories from their experiences under the same persecution. And it should be real interesting stuff. So yeah,
sounds good.
I need to discipline myself to get those out on a regular basis.
Well, I appreciate you joining in and sharing your story with us. And folks, we'll have all those links in the show notes here. As he was speaking, the website name, it popped up in the video. And by the way, I want to remind everybody that we do have a video version of this show on a YouTube channel of the same name, Leadership Powered by Common Sense. If you want to watch the video of what we're doing here, you can jump over there and see the other episodes as well. And of course, if you're listening via audio, we're out on all the popular channels, and there is an opportunity to download a transcript in the link for the where the website is on my side of things. So I think that's going to wrap it up for today, Gordon. Thank you much. And thank you again one last time for being part of the show.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity, Doug. I enjoyed it.
So I think the bottom line, folks, is so what that I'm going to share with you today is much of what we've been talking about. If you find yourself in the midst of an organization that is starting to feel incredibly dysfunctional, think about the warning signs that Gordon shared, and give yourself a test and see if the heat on that frog pot is starting to turn up, and find constructive, productive ways to deal with it. And you do have some choices should that not prevail, but hopefully you can get senior leadership attention and get it taken care of, because, you know, I think we all go to work with the intent to do the right thing. And occasionally we find ourselves in a situation where the organization seems to have shifted and is no longer interested in doing that right thing. So we have to ask ourselves the question, what do you really want to do about that? And that's the real compelling question. So hope this has been helpful to you. You have listened to another episode, and we thank you for joining in. We'll see you again next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Leadership Powered by Common Sense, hosted by Doug Thorpe. If you would like to know more about the coaching and advisory services he provides, visit DougThorpe.com.